This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 26, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Supreme Court hears arguments for and against same-sex marriage in a case challenging California's Proposition 8. The hunger strike by Guantanamo detainees spreads and solidarity actions take place across the U.S. And we'll go to Canada, where Indigenous youth conclude a 900-mile protest march for Aboriginal rights. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. The World Social Forum opened today in the capital of Tunisia, and tens of thousands of participants from more than 125 countries convened. The annual gathering began with a women's assembly. Shams Abdi, with the World March of Women, said that Tunisian women's struggle against the rise of Islamist rule is symbolic of worldwide struggles of people against power. Abdi added that having the global meeting seeking options to neoliberal policies in Tunisia is vital to the growth of the feminist movement in the North African country.
What really matters for us is that interchange between people, that we need to learn things from our friends, our feminine friends and feminists who are coming from other countries, and we need to talk to them as well about our struggle and our fight and to teach them our ways.
Yesterday, Algerian border police refused to allow nearly 100 Algerians bound for the event to cross into Tunisia. They wouldn't say why. The forum continues through March 30th. Many of the groups at the World Social Forum are global NGOs. In Russia, the government continues its massive raids of such groups. Yesterday, authorities searched the Moscow offices of Amnesty International. Jenny Johnson reports that hundreds of environmental, human rights, and free speech groups across the country say that officials have shown up unannounced and demanded access to their official documents.
The investigators are requesting copies of accounting documents, articles of incorporation, and other internal papers. Authorities say their purpose is to verify the organizations are in compliance with the law. A raft of new restrictions on NGOs has been enacted in recent months, including a controversial requirement for groups who receive support from abroad to register as foreign agents. Another bars foreigners and Russians with U.S. passports from holding leadership positions. Many groups said the authorities' goal is to scare them and to find some way they are violating the law. One group was warned of fire safety violations. Government officials in Moscow have sometimes been accompanied on raids by the pro-Kremlin television channel NTV. The channel is doing a series of so-called documentaries on the protest movement, which suggests it is funded by foreign governments that want to overthrow the current regime. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Russia.
A rebel leader accused of war crimes committed in the Democratic Republic of Congo appeared at the International Criminal Court at The Hague today, where an official delivered the charges.
The war crime of enlistment of children under the age of 15 and having them participate actively in hostilities, murder, rape, and sexual slavery, attack against the civilian population, pillaging constituting a war crime.
Bosco Ntaganda told the court that he was not guilty. Ntaganda was born in Rwanda and fled the country in his teens. An ethnic Tutsi, he joined the Rwandan Patriotic Army in the early 1990s and later fought with the Patriotic Forces for the Liberation of Congo in the gold-rich Ituri region. Ntaganda was a leader in the M23 rebel movement, which human rights groups claim is supported by the Rwandan military and has been accused of war crimes. Lawmakers in Washington state are considering a bill today that would ban employers from asking workers or prospective employees for their passwords to social media sites. Washington News Service's Chris Thomas reports that the bill has already unanimously passed the state Senate.
Social media has blurred the lines between personal privacy and employers' concerns about release of company secrets or unflattering product reviews. Seattle attorney Jesse Wing thinks it's important to set limits for how far employers can go to scope out their workforce.
For example, you could find out a person's age, whether they have disabilities, what their religion is, their sexual orientation. All this information might be on a person's social media site that they would never provide willingly, or an employer would know they're not allowed to find out.
The legislation would set a $500 civil penalty for employers who make demands found to violate workers' privacy. Employers could still search for any information in the public domain. Chris Thomas, Washington News Service.
Virginia's Republican Governor Bob McDonnell signed a voter ID bill today that critics say will disenfranchise elderly and minority voters. Yesterday, Arkansas's Democratic Governor Michael Beebe vetoed a similar bill that would require all voters to show photo IDs at the polls. The GOP-led legislature there plans an override, which shouldn't be difficult. Arkansas is one of only six states that requires a simple majority of elected lawmakers in both houses to overturn the governor. And in North Dakota today, the governor signed the nation's most restrictive abortion law in the U.S. to date, barring women from ending a pregnancy once a fetal heartbeat is present, as early as 6 weeks. Reproductive health advocates say they plan to appeal. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on California's Proposition 8 today. The case focuses on whether or not the ballot initiative violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution by banning same-sex couples from getting legally married in the state. The justices weighed thorny issues of legal standing, states' rights, and discrimination as they heard the opposing attorneys disagree on the purpose of marriage in society. FSRN's Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and brings us this report.
Waving rainbow flags, blasting music, and chanting equal justice under law, hundreds of supporters of same-sex marriage gathered outside the Supreme Court as the justices heard oral arguments in Hollingsworth versus Perry. The crowd cheered when lead plaintiff Kristen Perry exited the court with her partner Sandy Steer and their twin sons. She told reporters that the 2008 ballot initiative, Proposition 8, hurt her family by denying them a marriage license.
We look forward to a day when Proposition 8 is finally and officially eliminated and equality is restored to the state of California.
Though California still recognizes same-sex domestic partnerships and allows same-sex couples to adopt children, Chief Justice John Roberts had a heated exchange with Perry's lawyer, Ted Olson, on whether that ensures true equality.
All you're interested in is the label, and you insist on changing the definition of the label.
It is like you were to say you can vote, you can travel, but you may not be a citizen. There are certain labels in this country that are very, very critical. The case that's before you today is whether or not California can take a class of individuals based upon their characteristics, their distinguishing characteristics, remove from them the right of privacy, liberty, association, spirituality, and identity that marriage gives them.
Based on this argument, the court could rule in a way that only impacts California and the handful of other states that allow domestic partnerships but not same-sex marriage. The justices could also toss out the case if they decide that the backers of Proposition 8 don't have legal standing to bring the case to the Supreme Court. Traditionally, state officials have to be the ones to defend a state law, but when California's attorney general refused to do so, the original backers of the ballot measure stepped in. Some of the justices, including Sonia Sotomayor, expressed skepticism that they should be allowed to speak for California.
They proposed the ballot initiative because it was their individual views, not necessarily that of the state. And Your Honor, here, these individuals are not elected by the people or appointed by the people.
The lawyer defending Proposition 8, Charles Cooper, cited that the California Supreme Court had granted them standing in this case. He added that they were arguing for the law not out of personal beliefs about same-sex couples, but out of concern for society and, quote, traditional marriage. Justice Elena Kagan pressed him on this point.
It seems as though your principal argument is that same-sex and opposite-sex couples are not similarly situated because opposite-sex couples can procreate, same-sex couples cannot, and the state's principal interest in marriage is in regulating procreation. Is that basically correct?
Your Honor, that's the essential thrust of our position, yes.
Several justices took issue with this argument, pointing out that marriage licenses for straight couples don't come with a questionnaire about the couple's age, fertility, and intent to have children. Justice Stephen Breyer asked Cooper,
"What precisely is the way in which allowing gay couples to marry would interfere with the vision of marriage as procreation of children that allowing sterile couples of different sexes to marry would not? I mean, there are lots of people who get married who can't have children."
Cooper responded that including same-sex couples in the institution of marriage would change its, quote, historical focus from the bearing of children to the desires of adults. Many of the justices spoke of proceeding with caution on this issue, saying that same-sex marriage has only been legal for a few years, and there isn't enough evidence yet to know if it's good for society. But Attorney Olson told reporters that the justices have a legal and moral obligation to settle the debate now by writing a bold, sweeping opinion that recognizes a nationwide right to marriage equality. The court will hear another LGBT rights case on Wednesday, the United States versus Windsor, which challenges the federal law that denies federal benefits to legally married same-sex couples. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
At least three hunger strikers at the U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay detention facility have been hospitalized and 10 are being force-fed, according to a military spokesperson. The strike began last month. The military counts 28 prisoners as hunger strikers, but lawyers who have spoken to detainees say that the number is far higher and that the strike is spreading. About half of the 166 men currently held at Guantanamo have been cleared for release. The U.S. Southern Command has requested nearly $200 million in funds for Guantanamo, about $50 million for a new prison, calling into question if and when the facility would be closed or how the detainees would be released or brought to trial. This week, solidarity actions and hunger strikes are taking place across the U.S., and in a moment we're going to hear from an organizer in Chicago, but first we're joined by attorney David Reams. He represents several detainees at Guantanamo. He also represented Yemeni Adnan Latif, who was cleared for release but died while in custody last year. David Reams, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Monday, the U.S. military said three detainees are in hospital care, which include tube feedings and intravenous drips. What have you heard about the health of detainees participating in the hunger strike?
Well, I've heard absolutely awful things. I've heard that dozens have been falling unconscious as a result of the hunger strike. Blood sugar levels have dropped dangerously down, really into coma territory, and the only way that that can be treated, according to the military, is just to inject them with sugar water to bring up their levels, but the levels go down and they have to raise them up, and it's an endless cycle. Men are actually punished for becoming unconscious. The situation is critical. It's grave. I was at Guantanamo 3 weeks ago now, in the first week of March, and every one of my detainees who's in, every one of my client detainees who is in Camp 6, which is the locus of the hunger strike, had clearly lost a substantial amount of weight. They said they had lost, and that other detainees had lost at least 30 pounds, and that's a month ago, or 3 weeks ago, rather, into the hunger strike. The hunger strike continues to be a mass hunger strike.
And what have your clients told you about why the hunger strike is taking place now? Several detainees have cited searches beginning in February by Guantanamo guards and searches of Korans and regular confiscation of personal items as motivation for this latest strike. But what have you heard from the clients you've spoken to?
Well, I'd say the Koran issue is the straw that broke the detainees' back. But actually, it was the culmination of a series of events that began in September. They stormed Camp 6. They went into the communal areas. They menaced the detainees who lived there. They surrounded Camp 6 with three Hummers, armed Hummers. And then, in early February, the authorities conducted a thoroughly aggressive search of the men's cells. They confiscated all manner of items, and I'm simply here telling you what my clients have told me and what they've told and what others have told their lawyers. The guards ransacked the cells, removing kind of without rhyme or reason, items such as family letters, legal papers, blankets, mattresses. Some detainees ended up with nothing in their cells, others with a few things, and others with more than a few things. But it was incredibly intrusive.
That's attorney David Reams, who represents several Guantanamo detainees. As we mentioned, actions are taking place this week across the U.S. in solidarity with the hunger strike at Guantanamo. And we're joined now by Christopher Nestrick with Witness Against Torture. Christopher Nestrick, to kick off the week of action, you began with a protest near President Obama's home in Chicago. Tell us why you went there and what you're calling for.
Yeah, I think we're calling on him to actually live up to his promise. For more than 4 years, he has promised to close Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and still these men languish there. And also, as you said earlier, they're investing more money into it. And so really one of the only person right now in our government is that can take action to close the facility is President Obama. So we want to send a message to him clearly that these hunger strikes in Guantanamo are happening because you have failed to live up to your promise. And people are trying to send a message to say, you know, enough is enough. And let's respect the most basic human rights of people around the world.
Well, actions are taking place not just in Chicago, but in other cities as well, Los Angeles, New York, Des Moines, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. What else is planned for the week?
Yeah, this week we are, there's lots of different ways people can participate. People are sending letters and calling the White House. They're calling U.S. Southern Command to voice their opposition to both Guantanamo Bay prison camp and the indefinite detention of the prisoners there. But also, you know, our message is also directed at the prisoners there that are resisting, and that we are listening to the cries of the people in Guantanamo and support them in their hunger strike.
Christopher Nestrick with Witness Against Torture spoke to us from Chicago, where he's taking part in actions this week to coincide with the ongoing hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay and against indefinite detention. Christopher Nestrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is FSRN reporter Claudia Cragg, Asia Pacific reporter. For more than a decade, FSRN has brought global stories and local voices to your airwaves. But a funding crisis now threatens to force us to turn off our signal forever. To find out more about how you can support independent journalism, visit fsrn.org.
In Canada, a group of Indigenous youth who walked more than 900 miles in sub-zero temperatures wrapped up a historic voyage yesterday. They're drawing inspiration from the Idle No More movement and calling for Aboriginal rights and land protection. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story.
The walkers left their community of Wat-Magistui in the Hudson Bay region of northern Quebec more than a month ago, on January 16th. Yesterday, they reached their final destination, the nation's capital, Ottawa. When they began their journey, the group included 6 marchers and 1 guide, but by the time they arrived in Ottawa, there were nearly 5,000 supporters who met the youth at the end of their march on Parliament Hill.
Harper's cabinet sits right here! Let them hear you!
Many of the Nishiyu walkers are teenagers, and the youngest is an 11-year-old girl. They are calling their walk the Journey of the Nishiyu. The landscape of their route was unforgiving, with temperatures sometimes going down to minus 40 degrees. They walked an average of 16 miles per day using snowshoes, hoping to reconnect with the traditions of their Cree ancestors. The marchers followed along traditional trading routes of the Cree, Algonquin, and Mohawk nations. Their goal was to unite Indigenous youth across Canada, said David Coopit, the 18-year-old Cree man who initiated the voyage. Yesterday, Coopit spoke to an enthusiastic and emotional crowd on Parliament Hill in Ottawa.
There's no words to describe how I feel. There's a tremendous pride and happiness, but also an emotion that I can't describe. This is not the end. It will continue. It started with a walk. I thank all of you and give you my love.
The journey of the Nishiyu was inspired by the Idle No More movement for Indigenous self-determination, which swept across Canada and around the world earlier this year. The movement formed partly in response to a controversial law that passed in December 2012. The legislation, Bill C-45, eliminated environmental protections for thousands of lakes and rivers in Canada. Many Aboriginal people say that the bill also infringes on treaty rights. Shortly after the bill passed, Cree Chief Teresa Spence from the community of Attawapiskat went on a hunger strike for 6 weeks to demand a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister. She and other First Nations people want the bill revoked. Spence ended her hunger strike in late January after opposition parties signed a declaration of commitment to carry her cause forward in Parliament. Diane Reed, a Cree woman who helped cook food for the Nishiyu marchers along the way, said that Chief Spence inspired her people to take action.
I always knew that the day, when the day of the voice of a woman rises up, that the First Nations would hear that voice, because we are the life givers as women. And when a woman rises up and a chief, you know, that voice is heard, and you know, it just reverberates to the Aboriginal nation across this country and throughout the world.
While I Don't Know More actions are less frequent now than they were during the winter, the movement shows no signs of slowing down. Last week, I Don't Know More formed an alliance with the Aboriginal Defenders of the Land Network and called for a Solidarity Spring and Sovereignty Summer, sustain nonviolent direct actions over the next few months, including road and rail blockades. In Ottawa yesterday, the Nishiyu walkers were joined by Indigenous people from numerous different nations, as well as labor unions and other social justice groups. Audrey Redman from the Dakota Nation in Saskatchewan met up with the marchers in Ottawa to walk with them on the final leg of their journey to Parliament Hill.
Enough taking the land, enough taking the resources. Yeah, you say you have, you know, economic strategies and all of that, but it doesn't make any difference to the land. You're still stripping it of resources, and you're still taking out what we really ought not to be taking out now. And all people in Canada, and I think everywhere, we have to stop doing what we're doing and really start paying attention to the earth and stop paying attention to ourselves so much.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper was not present to meet the Cree marchers. Instead, he was at the Toronto International Airport to greet two panda bears that had been shipped from China and are headed for Canadian zoos. Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcourt met briefly with the Nishiyu marchers yesterday. While the minister made no promises on policy changes, he did accept an invitation to come visit the Cree community later this summer. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Ottawa.
In California, more than 11,000 households who borrowed from the nation's largest mortgage lender, Wells Fargo, currently face foreclosure. Those foreclosures could cost the state more than $3 billion in lost revenue, according to a new report from a housing rights organization that examines the effects of Wells Fargo's foreclosure policies on distressed homeowners and hard-hit communities. FSRN's Max Pringle reports.
Homeowners and their supporters gathered at a recent rally at San Francisco's Wells Fargo headquarters to draw attention to the impact of the bank's policies on the state's economy. According to a new report, banks have foreclosed on approximately 1.7 million California homes since 2008, and about 65,000 California homeowners are currently in the foreclosure pipeline, with Wells Fargo leading the way.
Wells Fargo, which is one of the largest servicers in California, have about 11,616 people in their foreclosure pipeline.
That's about 20% of the loans facing foreclosure in California, says Grace Martinez, an organizer with the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, which co-authored California in Crisis, How Wells Fargo's Foreclosure Pipeline is Damaging Local Communities. Martinez says if Wells Fargo does foreclose on that many borrowers, the economic impact would be felt statewide. Each home would lose approximately 22% of its value, for a total loss of more than $1 billion. And homes in the surrounding neighborhood would lose value too, for an additional loss of about $2.2 billion.
We've got members in Oakland and LA, all the way down to San Diego and Sacramento, who are impacted by not only Wells Fargo's practices, but also by the refusal to actually provide any type of principal reduction.
According to the report, Wells Fargo's mortgage principal reduction policies are the least generous of the major banks when renegotiating mortgages. For example, Wells Fargo forgives about $74,000 per average principal reduction, while Bank of America writes down nearly $200,000 per average principal reduction. But Wells Fargo disputes the report, saying it has had an aggressive principal reduction policy in place since 2009. The bank declined an interview but released a statement saying that most of the more than $6 billion in principal forgiveness it's given out during the mortgage crisis has gone to California borrowers. It also says its delinquency and foreclosure rates are 4% below the national average. But Peter Fairfield has had a different experience. He and his wife took out a home equity loan 4 years ago to shore up their flagging photography business. They now face foreclosure on the San Francisco home they've been in for the last 34 years.
Wells Fargo sold me a loan that I couldn't afford. They promised that they would refinance it so that we could make the payments, but that never happened.
Fairfield says his family was the victim of predatory lending, and when the rent on their business went up $5,000 overnight, they went to Wells Fargo to find a solution and were met with
false promises, lost paperwork, month after month after month of trustee sales hanging over my head, never knowing what's going on, not getting return phone calls. It's just enough to make you want to head to the bridge. But we're not doing that. We're fighting.
Another San Francisco homeowner, Manuela Alvarez, says she had a similar experience. She took out a home improvement loan with Wells Fargo a few years back. The loan payment skyrocketed after the mortgage meltdown. Her jobs at a hair salon and at nursing homes doing hair for the elderly weren't enough to make the payments, so she rented out part of her home. That got her household income up to about $6,000 per month. But the bank wasn't impressed.
Sacrificing my kitchen and my living room in order to qualify. And they told me that it wasn't enough. In order for me to qualify, I had to make $11,000 a month.
Among other recommendations, the report suggests that Wells Fargo make principal reduction a core front-end strategy when considering loan modifications, release ethnicity and income data on borrowers facing foreclosure, and put a moratorium on foreclosures until these steps are put into place. Max Pringle, FSRN, San Francisco.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Puck Lowe and Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Thanks for listening today in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.